Good afternoon. I'm very happy to be with you today. I've enjoyed participation in lots of the seminars and discussions so far today, and glad you're still with us late in the afternoon. We'll try to keep it lively and interesting in our discussion of strategic culture in the period that we have, and we welcome the discussant's perspective as well. I actually wrote a paper which is connected to the talk today, and I have copies that are available later on, which summarizes the comparative approach to strategic culture that has been outlined through several generations of literature, inside and outside the discipline of political science, and it's been detailed over 3 to 4 generations of scholarship. This scholarship has also generated a great deal of criticism, analysis, and response, and I'll mention that in passing as well. I'll conclude my brief talks with a list of things to do, a to-do list of challenges and questions for further development in the literature. Cultural approaches to strategic studies have been around actually for centuries, and many of you here are quite familiar with past works, traditional works, that emphasize the connection between culture and politics, the connection between culture and national security policy over time. Thucydides and Sun Tzu's work, clearly Clausewitz's attention to war and warfighting strategy as, quote, a test of moral and physical forces, with the goal of eliminating the enemy's morale as much as defeating them on the battlefield, a very important theme. National character studies into the 20th century, during World War II, national character studies, which defined interesting perspectives on why Japan and Germany were doing what they were doing at the time, and which later drew a great deal of criticism we'll discuss together. Russell Weigley's classic 1973 piece, The American Way of Warfare, and then more recently Jack Snyder's work on Soviet nuclear strategy. Some then of the many examples of scholarship over time that have identified cultural roots of national security policy. However, in the contemporary context, we have new attention to issues of how culture may influence national security policy. Recent events have renewed our interest, including just several that I could list off the top of my head in creating this bullet point chart. September 11 has gotten us all thinking about the role of culture in world politics. U.S.-China trade disputes, another example, Bush administration issues, connections to culture. Nuclear tensions with Iran, very much in the news and very much a connection. I like number 4, Kagan's argument about the Europeans as Venusians, right? Americans are from Mars, Europeans are from Venus. Somewhere, somehow, that has to have cultural roots that we'll explore a little bit together, and other examples of contemporary cases that have identified issues and have led us more and more to identify challenges in international security through the lens, if you will, of culture or strategic culture. But I do want to emphasize that as much new attention has emerged on this subject, we have so many new questions. New attention prompts new questions philosophically, theoretically, and practically. What are the ideational foundations of national security policy? A nice philosophical question. What has constructivism done for cultural theories of interpretation? I'll argue that it has both energized and challenged and undercut strategic cultural arguments in the last decade. What are the origins of strategic culture? The keepers of strategic culture? Who keeps strategic culture? Who carries these values forward in modern world politics, and a question of permanency, semi-permanency versus transition or evolution in strategic culture over time. Finally, a fascinating question about universality. Who can have strategic cultures? Countries, nations, states, supranational organizations like the European Union, for example, and even transnational actors like terrorist networks. Interesting questions for investigation together. I conclude ultimately that these questions prompt many areas for further development, substantial avenues for more attention. A brief literature review, if you'll allow me, connection back to what I'll say are early studies of culture and politics, and here we have clearly a 20th century zoom-in focus, national character studies in the 1940s and 50s, Ruth Benedict's classic, The Chrysanthemum and the Sword, Japanese military cultural study. Early works defining the roots of a nation's character or culture in language, religion, customs, socialization, and interpretation of common memories. However, I do want to point out that while national character studies drew interesting attention in the 1940s and 50s and were early and rough tools of threat assessment, they also drew a lot of challenge about reification of the concept of culture and about stereotyping, even racial discrimination. Nonetheless, explorations of the role of culture shifted mainly to sociology and anthropology in the 50s and on into the 60s with works by Mead, Douglas Geertz, Levi Strauss, and others. The 1960s, we come back to attention to the role of culture in politics with Verba and Allman studies of political culture. A fairly high-profile set of studies done in the early 1960s studying how political culture may be that subset of beliefs and values in a society that relate to the political system. Verba and Allman argue that beliefs and values include a commitment to democratic principles and institutions, ideas about morality and the use of force, predispositions about the role of a country in world politics. Political culture, they argued, manifests itself on at least three levels: the cognitive, evaluative, and expressive. This first generation, then, of cultural works, paying attention to the connection between culture and politics in the 20th century, was popular and interesting in many ways, but it did also draw a great deal of criticism. Critics charged that political cultural studies were epiphenomenal, subjective, reifications, once again that criticism comes up, and ultimately, with the behavioral revolution in the social sciences by the 60s and 70s, cultural studies fell out of favor. To be revisited in the late 1970s by Jack Snyder and other scholars who were interested in strategic culture, bringing the idea of culture into modern security studies by examining how culture could influence strategy and security policy decision making. Clearly, we want to say Snyder's argument about the role of culture in the dark days of the Cold War was an alternative to neorealism, was an alternative to structural realism. It was an attempt to understand the origins of national strategy in ideational foundations, and in that way it drew a great deal of attention. Snyder argued elites articulate a unique strategic culture related to security military affairs that is a wider manifestation of public opinion, socialized into distinctive modes of strategic thinking. Ultimately, the prediction: strategic culture leads to specific nuclear strategy choices, or strategy choices related to the use of military force. In this case, the Soviets, based on strategic culture, had a preference for a preemptive, offensive uses of force, and the origins of this could be found rooted in a history of insecurity and authoritarianism. Nuclear strategy, then, Snyder and his supporters argued, could be predicted, even that of potential adversaries. Nuclear strategy and strategic cultural studies in the late 1970s also drew some attention and criticism in the 1980s. Some of the standard criticism I've already mentioned before about reification and epiphenomenal and subjective characteristics. Also, the new criticism of works in the late 70s and the early 80s, works by Snyder, Ken Booth, Colin Gray, that this work was primarily historical, narrow, and contextual. Ironically, with the abrupt end of the Cold War and the non-use of nuclear weapons to achieve the end of the Cold War, strategic cultural studies again fell out of favor in the discipline, only to be resurrected yet again in strategic cultural studies inspired by the rise of constructivism. And again, sorry to be running so quickly through this. I do have copies of a paper or the outline I can share with folks if they're interested. In the 1990s, constructivism energizes a new wave of thinking about the ideational sources of fill in the blank. In this case, the ideational sources of national security and strategic decisions. Well, that's interesting. Perhaps someone here knows how to control the lights. I can keep talking, no problem. But
yeah, everything went out in the hallway too, so we're just going to go figure out what happened.
Okay. Back. Yeah, back up.
Yep.
Good job. Constructivism then inspires a new wave of attention to strategic culture and the ideational sources of national security. I need not go into the details of constructivist approaches here. However, we'll mention that Alexander Wendt and others have articulated interesting arguments about social constructions by knowledgeable practice. This new generation, also called the third generation of scholarship on strategic culture, then leads to some interesting works. Works by a number of scholars, including, of course, Alistair Ian Johnston. Alistair Ian Johnston's work, Cultural Realism, Strategic Culture and Grand Strategy in Chinese History, is a quintessential third generation work. Also works with attention to the role of norms in international security. In some ways, in relation to threat assessment, the study of security norms lies at the intersection of constructivism and cultural works, with the interesting arguments raised by Nina Tannenwald and others about things like nuclear taboos, an ideational source of strategic decision-making, it could be argued. Also, studies of military organizational culture, Keir, Rosen, Abel, Terras, and Cochran, and others. Third-generation works like Alistair Ian Johnson's work, like works by Thomas Berger, Thomas Banchoff, John Duffield, on Japanese and German security policies and strategic cultures in the post-Cold War era. Very interesting. I love John Duffield's quote about what strategic culture is. The overall effect of national security culture is to predispose societies in general and political elites in particular toward certain actions and policies over others. Then that line, some options will simply not be imagined. Some are more likely to be rejected as inappropriate or ineffective than others. Some options, therefore, based on strategic culture, will simply not be imagined in terms of strategic choice. Nuclear norms and taboos, a fascinating connection to threat assessment, and one that we don't have much time to discuss today, although I welcome one-on-one conversation about it. A research agenda for strategic culture. So inspired by constructivism, where are we at in the last decade? We're at facing a recognition. The literature suggests growing ties, importance of ties between culture and strategic behavior, links between internal and external determinants, cultural theories inspired by constructivism, but also by cross-disciplinary works, sociology, anthropology, psychology, inspired by constructivism, much more than an explanation of last resort. That said, strategic cultural studies, even inspired by constructivism, leave many unanswered questions and leave many areas for further attention. Questions about common definitions, delineations of the pathways of strategic culture, the applicability of Western and traditional models to non-Western countries. Regarding threat assessment, for example, as a digression, the idea that studies of North Korea and Iran focus on dysfunction of decision-making from our Western perspective, perhaps ignoring significant cultural determinants that suggest more order to the process than meets the Western eye, if you'll allow that cultural interpretive argument. How applicable are Western and traditional models to non-Western countries? And ultimately, the argument that cultural studies, unlike some constructivist works, recognize the need for defined ontology and falsifiable middle-range theory. A to-do list for strategic culture. Based on interesting literature and fascinating debates over three or four generations, there is a set of things we need to pay attention to. Number one, develop common definitions. Number two, explore the origins of strategic culture. Number three, identify the keepers of strategic culture. Four, delineate scope conditions. And five, develop models of strategic cultural change. For the last few minutes, I'll articulate a few ideas to support that list. Number one, develop common definitions. One would think that based on four generations of scholarship, based on extensive work on cultural determinants of national security policy, strategic culture has been accepted as an independent variable in studies of security policy. It has not. Debates rage about the articulation of what strategic culture itself is, much less, or no less, the study of connections between strategic culture and security policy decision making. Third bullet point suggests that strategic culture has been interpreted as a generator of preferences, a vehicle for the perpetuation of preferences and values, and a force for action and revitalization and renewal of these values. It is at once all things or nothing. Scholars must pay careful attention then to the need for common definitions. And ontological agnosticism, I would argue, is not a solid foundation for constructive, for middle range progressive theoretical development. Number two, just a suggested model of the many possible sources of origins of strategic culture, both physical, material, and ideational, political considerations and sociocultural considerations. The importance of myths and symbols as much as the importance of geography and resources. Not to mention the pervasive influence of transnational normative pressures. Number three, the keepers of strategic culture. I'll summarize this page by simply saying, is strategic culture a property of collectives or a property of individual decision makers? Progressive literature suggests that we can identify the keepers of strategic culture, those who hold the values that countries believe deeply in, and that leaders have an ability to manipulate latitude to expand, stretch, and change strategic cultural tenets through discourse. The bottom there, leaders decide when and where to consciously adapt and employ strategic cultural tenets. Perhaps, as some authors would suggest, leaders are strategic users of culture who define the limits of the possible. A hierarchy of political culture. Who are the keepers of political culture? Well, most of us could probably agree that these four levels of actors are significant. Elites, the elite decision authority, those with the authority to allocate government resources, political institutions, military organizations, and or foreign policy bureaucracies. And a quick point here, the military organizations need not be the sole keepers of a strategic cultural orientation. Look at Japan, Germany, and other examples, where the legislatures or the foreign ministries are the institutions that perpetuate the strategic cultural mainstream, and public attitudes and preferences. Scope conditions. And here, Carrie Karchner will elaborate a little bit more on the idea of scope conditions for strategic culture, asking tough questions about when and where we might identify strategic culture and strategic cultural tenets. For example, are authoritarian systems the easy place to find strategic cultures? Or are strategic subcultures simply harder to find in authoritarian systems? Can non-state actors have strategic cultures? Can regional organizations have them? Interesting possibilities for authoritarian strategic cultures: the North Korean ideology of Juche, self-reliance; the Iranian strategic culture, which connects to specific attributes of Shiism; and the long history of the Persian civilization. Scope conditions for strategic culture, and I'll simply pass by this slide because Carrie will raise a few hypotheses about conditions under which we may be more likely to find and identify strategic culture, such as high homogeneity in societies. Non-state and supranational actors. Is there such a thing as a European Union strategic culture? As hard as EU politicos try, will they ever be able to get there? Is there such a thing as an Al-Qaeda strategic culture? The role of technology in globalization pushes these questions as well. And finally, models of change. Traditional scholarship on culture and strategic culture tends to focus on continuity, even a semi-permanence that is established over generations, that becomes a tough filter through which any events may be processed. But modern studies suggest the possibility for restructuring in the face of specific challenges or conditions, external shocks, or what I call strategic cultural dissonance. When several tenets of a strategic culture come into conflict with one another, what will the country or the culture resolve? the strategic cultural strain of aversion to the use of military force versus promotion of human rights? Was dissonance for German leaders in the 1990s in the face of genocide in Kosovo and other examples? The way forward, the modest goal of bringing culture back into national security studies, developing culturally sensitive or targeted models which allow us to make more precise and accurate threat assessments, and overcoming the barriers of the paradigmatic approaches in our discipline. Some have suggested that a problem with bringing culture back in is a certain defensiveness on the part of realists who see this idea as a sideshow. And I'd welcome further discussion of this with anyone here or colleagues who have been here earlier. How far can strategic cultural models stretch while retaining any sort of legitimacy? And finally, Jeffrey Checkle's warning, remember this, let's develop rich studies. Culturalists and comparative constructivist work, however, need to be mindful about emergent ad hocism in our work, building bridges, developing progressive models for future research. I welcome further discussion. Thanks for your attention.